For this morning's talk, which is the first real talk of our January 2020 retreat. So, what should I talk about? Oh, I know, meditation. A lot of people, they say, well, how do you meditate? And the answer which comes to my mind is one of those great stories from Ajahn Chah. Now, this Ajahn Chah was a really amazing meditator, but even to the point that when he did have a stroke later on in his life, the monks had a meeting. I'd just come to Australia at that time, maybe about a month. I don't know exactly 2 weeks, a month, 6 weeks, somewhere around that time. Ajahn Chah had a stroke, and so half of that time he couldn't speak, very sick, and all the monks had a meeting. So what should we do next? And they decided just to let nature take its course, and just no need to keep him alive, just let him just fade away gently, slowly, or whatever happens. But then the king of Thailand at the time heard about that and said, no, you have to keep him alive. And so, even though it should really be like Sangha business, monk business, it was in Thailand. And in Thailand, the king of Thailand is really important. So they decided, okay, we'll keep him alive. So because of that, they had a special place built for him. And also they had usually a couple of monks. And the king of Thailand paid for a nurse, a medic, to be on duty all time. 8-hour shifts, throughout the day and night. And one of the monks told me this story, which is a wonderful little story about how Ajahn Chah, even when he was that sick, could still really meditate full on. Because every now and again, when Ajahn Chah was meditating, or was actually sick, he stopped breathing. And the medic became very concerned. Wow! If you're not breathing, you're going to die. And the monk said, no, it does this all the time. Leave him alone. He just gets into deep meditation. Because in deep meditation, you don't need any air. Because your mind is so still. Your car doesn't need petrol when it's in the garage. So they said, no, leave him alone. He said, no, he'll die. So he's going to die anyway one day. What's the big deal? And the medic said, well, I know he's going to die one day, but I don't want Ajahn Chah to die on my shift. Which is quite understandable. And so they said, oh, look, he's leaving me alone. He said, I can't. So they came upon this little deal, like a compromise. So the medic, the nurse, it's not really a nurse, but more like a medic, said, well, I will take blood samples every minute or two. And as long as the blood is well oxygenated, then obviously it doesn't need to breathe. So yeah, okay, fair enough. And so they took blood samples of Ajahn Chah every few minutes, and it was always well oxygenated, even though he wasn't breathing. Da da da. So Ajahn Chah, even though when he was sick, he would still sort of meditate. And that's how we knew that he was still doing his jhana stuff. So anyway, that's with Ajahn Chah. But he was a very great monk. And also that on this occasion, this was the occasion when a Swedish lecturer, a doctor from the university, he's actually a professor, came to visit. Are there any people from Sweden here today? Any Swedish people? Oh, yeah, okay. I'll try and just make it less. Anyway, so the Swedish professor came. He'd been visiting all the senior meditation gurus and masters in Asia, and now he'd come to see Ajahn Chah. And he said he'd been sent by the Swedish government to find out about meditation. So you can imagine how long ago this was. It was about 40 years ago. Swedish government was very advanced. Very good. One of the first countries to see this meditation is something in this. So they sent the professor, and being a professor had four questions. He was asking all these great meditation teachers, ajahns, gurus, swamis, whatever, and roshis in Japan or Korea, asking all of them the same four questions. Because that's what they do in university. Ask the same questions, get different answers, compare them, and then you can write up your thesis and get a PhD. He didn't need a PhD, he was already a professor, but you get the idea. So, four questions. And the four questions were, what is meditation? Second question, how do you meditate? Third question, why do you meditate? And fourth question, what do you get out of meditation? Standard four questions. What is meditation? How do you meditate? Why do you meditate? What do you get out of meditation? And it was wonderful being around a teacher like Ajahn Chah. Because, you know, he didn't do anything like normally. He was always eccentric, in the sense, doing things in a slightly different way to make a very strong point. So when those questions were translated to Ajahn Chah, then Ajahn Chah, it's important, from the government of Sweden. So he said, I need a piece of paper and a pencil. Never in my life have I seen him ask for a piece of paper and a pencil before. He was, as I used to say, up to one of his tricks. And we couldn't wait to see what he had planned. And so, when he got the piece of paper, he asked for the questions translated again. Oh, yeah. And he wrote something down. And then he looked up, scratched his head, which I'd never seen him do before, and then write something else down. He was acting out. And afterwards, when he finished the last question, he handed it to the translator. And as usually happens in such anecdotes, it took the translator a couple of minutes to stop laughing before he translated the answers back to the professor. And so the translator said, you know, Professor, my great master's answer to your first question, you know, what is meditation? His answer is, what is eating? The answer to the second question, how do you meditate? My master's answer is, how do you eat? The third question, why do you meditate? Why do you eat? And the fourth question, what do you get out of meditation? The great master's answer is, what do you get out of eating? And the professor was not happy. Because he didn't meditate, he just studied. He said, I can't take that back to my government. And Ajahn Chah said, that's all you're getting. So Ajahn Chah would not write anything more down on a piece of paper. But that wasn't just a joke. It was funny because it was unexpected. But of course, if it comes from a great master like Ajahn Chah, you contemplate it afterwards and think, how true is that? What is meditation? I was saying something about that yesterday. I think you all know what meditation is, otherwise you wouldn't be here, would you? You come here to learn how to meditate, so you have to have some idea what it is, some idea of the benefits of it. Either that or you just learn that the place is very comfortable and hasn't got a great cook. That might be what you're here for the food. But I don't think so. Now you come, many people come from so many different countries overseas and have to take time off, having to get all the permissions to travel and stuff. You don't have that much free time these days. So, he says, you know, you get some idea what meditation is. It's something beautiful. But then they answer the second question, how do you meditate? And of course, you know, the answer is, how do you eat? How do you eat? You just had breakfast. Why did you choose what you wanted to eat this morning? And how did you eat it? There's something about eating that it's, you know, well, I'll go to the third or fourth answer, that's all. Why do you eat? It's actually for physical health. I made a point, physical health. If you eat too much, eat the wrong food, you may get physical, well, you don't get physical health at all, you get some physical ill health. And it's the same with meditation. Meditation is what Ajahn Chah used to say, and I don't think just Ajahn Chah, many monks would say this in that time. He called it food for the heart or food for the mind. It's like spiritual food, meditation. And just like physical food, if you don't eat the right food, which is right for you, then you get physically sick. Too much, even good food, you get sick. Too little, you get sick. You've just got to find that just right amount, that balance. And how do you find the balance of exactly how much food you need? I think many of you know that one of my favourite foods is baked beans. That's actually, it's vegetarian, it's very healthy for you. Maybe, at least, it keeps me going. And even like today, my very, very kind attendant gave me this big bowl of baked beans, and I had the choice today. Should I finish off the bowl of baked beans, or should I be restrained? And just put some in the fridge for tomorrow. And so I was very proud of myself. I was restrained. It wasn't taking much restraint. It was, no, I'm going to have enough for today. So that is know exactly how much you need and how much you don't need. It's not just what you like to eat. It's actually just how much you want to eat and how it will digest and what you have to do today. I don't have to do anything physical today, just sit up here talking most of the day. So this does all the work. So because of that, you don't need too much food. And because of that, you know exactly why do you eat. You're aware of how much you're eating or what's it doing to your tummy. But it's also you're kind as well. Kind to your body. This body's got to go through today. It's going to have lunch later on. And so you just take the right amount. And that kindness, that wisdom, so you're happy, well-fed, at ease in your body. And that's how the Buddha said to meditate. As you eat, so you meditate. So in other words, how much you try to meditate? You know, there's so many theories about what is the best food to eat. And there's health foods and diets, and what is the right food today, what is the right food tomorrow. We found out all the dietary advice. I think we have an article over in people get the New Scientist over in the monastery. I like the article because it said, well, basically we don't know exactly what is the best food to eat. It's from a really good scientist. And that sort of reminded me, because I was what's called like a hard scientist. Theoretical physics, you can't get harder than that except pure maths. And even, I started off in just pure maths at Cambridge, and even my friends said, you're selling out. Becoming a theoretical physicist, that's, not as logical and rational as, being a mathematician. If you want to know exactly why, there was this story of a philosopher, a theoretical physics, and a mathematician in a train going through some beautiful country somewhere, say in Australia. And they looked out the window and they saw some sheep. And one of those sheep was black, the rest were all white. And the philosopher said, oh yeah, there are some black sheep over in this part of the world. That's what the philosopher said, because he saw one through the window. And the physicist said, no. All we know, there is one black sheep in this country. No more than that. And the mathematician said, no. All we know, that there is one sheep, one side of which is black. We can't see the other side. So that's a pure mathematician for you. So you can understand from that just sometimes that when we're learning how to meditate, we can't make too many assumptions. What works for you will not work for you. What works for you may not work for somebody else. But when we have our own mindfulness and kindness, they become the core sort of watch points of our meditation practice. how much do you need to meditate? And how are you going to meditate? So, just like making a meal. I don't know if you've done any cooking, but I haven't cooked anything for 45 years now. But if you, I remember when I did do my own cooking, I made a big mistake as a student. I started baking my own bread. And trouble was, when I baked my own bread, it's amazing, just the smell of bread. You know, if you want to know where all your friends are, bake some bread, because as soon as it comes out of the oven, they all appear. They all want some. And that was supposed to be the supply of bread for 3 or 4 days. It only lasted an hour. But anyway, it's good fun to share it with everybody. But whenever you do any cooking, how many of you, if you cook your food, you cook it and you don't really follow recipes? You just, you know, have a look, and it's sort of a recipe, but then you taste it. That needs a bit more salt. A bit more chili. And little by little, you're mindful and you're kind. You experiment, you taste the product until you find out exactly just what is the delicious point, the beautiful point. And that you can't give instructions for. I can't say, put in 2.642 grams of salt and put in 1.65 litres of oil or whatever. I'm not sure what I'm talking about, but you get the idea. Just to make sure that you balance it just the right amount. And then you can actually taste it. And that is basically how to meditate. You can give instructions, and I will give instructions in a few minutes because people love instructions. I don't know why, but what you want, that's what you will get. Sometimes. So people like instructions, but when you have instructions, please, no, look at it like a recipe. Just you look at it, and then maybe this way, maybe that way. Even, you know, when we built Jhana Grove, you know, we had to get plans in through the local. Is anyone here from Serpentine Gerardale Council? Good. So when we when we did the plans, we had all the plans. You have to have plans to get building permission, planning permission, whatever other permissions you need. All these things you have to sign. And then when I showed the plans to the builder, he took a look at them and he looked at me and he said, "So, do I have to really do it this way?" I said, "No, like I trust you. These are just for permissions, roughly about this. So let's actually just innovate and do it this way, do it that way." And so that's the sort of builder I like, who would actually do a little bit and then see what it needs next and then next. But don't just always follow plans which were put in place years ago and then you have to keep to them. Just tweak it this way, tweak it that way to make it more interesting. So that's always what we've done here. This place has just grown. And that's actually how you meditate as well. You don't have this grand plan, this is what I'm supposed to do. Okay, now this is stage one, this is stage two, this is stage three, this is stage four. And then, because otherwise you become a prisoner of the plan. Rather than using your wisdom and kindness to adapt the meditation and to work it all out, how you need to meditate today. Or not even today, this morning. Not even this morning, 8:20 in the morning. So that you innovate, you're mindful and aware, kind. And that's actually how we learn our meditation, in the same way as cooking. That's how to meditate. Why to meditate? Keep the why in mind. Why are you meditating here? What are you trying to get out of this? Those are the last two questions, which the Swedish professor asked. Why? Now, one of those is obviously peace, wisdom, and I'm going to put in happiness as well. Sometimes people come to meditate because they're dying of cancer. And they come here. It's amazing things which happen when you meditate, not all the time, you know, but at least sometimes you get these amazing things happen. And people come here, they learn this, they learn that. Sometimes, there's this one guy who came here once and he said, "Well, why did you come here?" He said, "I was sent by my wife." He didn't want to come, he wasn't a Buddhist. His wife booked him in, said, "You go." Okay. So he enjoyed it and had a wonderful time and learnt a lot from it. So why are you here today? Why have you come for meditating? What do you want? So maybe those few things like some peace, some health, some happiness, some insight. But when we get to the last one, insight, understanding, now that is the most dangerous one. And I say that with a lot of care because everybody thinks they have insight. Even people who've only meditated once. They think they're wise. Oh yeah, I've been there, done that. Because sometimes the idea of people is to knowledge, understanding, somehow is part of their self, who they are. I am the philosopher, I am the physicist, I am the monk, I am the senior nun. Whatever it is, sometimes because of your experience, your knowledge, and you're tying this idea of a self to whatever you understand, that means that the wisdom becomes very dangerous. To the point that I've seen people arguing the most stupid, ridiculous theories to one another, thinking that's insight. It's not insight, it's just theories. So insight, we can never really be that certain that how we understand is true, which is why the people come and ask me, Ajahn Brahm, is that the Dhamma? I say, no. Are you only just saying that to test me, aren't you? I know when you say no, that means yes. And they try and twist it around. Oh, I still remember this lady. Oh, she was not Swedish, by the way. So, you'll say, no Swedish people, okay. No, I think she was Malaysian. How many people from Malaysia here? I know a lot of you were born in Malaysia. Anyway, this Malaysian, she was, her father was really wealthy, so she never had to work in her life. She used to go around to different monks and monasteries and become enlightened, or that's what she wanted to do. But anyway, on this occasion, she was staying with this monk, Ajahn Tate. And when she was with Ajahn Tate, she thought, I've got to have him confirm that what I just experienced was the fourth jhana. I saw her meditating. She was meditating like this. It wasn't the fourth jhana. It was fast asleep. But there's one thing about the fourth jhana, I've mentioned this later on. In that fourth jhana, you're not thinking. Really peaceful, very still. I said, well, I wasn't thinking. It was jhana, Ajahn Tate, wasn't it? Ajahn Tate said, no, it's not jhana, that's sleep. And she was one of the people who thought, he's just testing me, that's what he's doing. He said, but this is what I did. I was sitting cross-legged in a meditation hall and it got very, very peaceful. It's fourth jhana, isn't it? I said, no. So she started again. And, you know, she was going to keep on going until the final thing happened. She said, it was fourth jhana, wasn't it? I confirmed. And then she left. And she went around telling me and everybody else, it's been confirmed, that's fourth jhana. That's the trouble with insight. I'm trying to understand things. Sometimes we only see what we want to see. But against that in meditation, we've got something which is like your peace and happiness. That is much easier to understand. Not a peace which is like the peace of falling fast asleep, but the peace when you're just having your lunch and you're just taking it, it's only just the last like banana left. And the one in front of you, they've already got their banana, there's only one left, they take the second one as well. How do you feel? Now that is a sign your meditation is going really well. When you say, oh, please take it. But if you decide, no, I've got to teach you a lesson and take two because you're the teacher, and take off her plate, that is, that's not wisdom at all. That's not peace. Peace is something which you can understand. You can't think peace. That's why it is a much better indicator of what we're getting out of meditation and why we meditate. That sense of peace in your life. And I think you can understand what I'm talking about there, because that's one reason why many people come to a meditation center. Out there in the life, people are arguing, rushing around, doing this and doing that, and it drives you mad and crazy sometimes. Just watching people, how much they I mention this point many times because I do travel around a lot. The last place I went to was Singapore and Penang and Kuala Lumpur. And you know, those are big cities. Before then, the time before was over in UK, in London. You know, London is a huge city. There's hardly any human beings there. The same with Singapore and Kuala Lumpur and Penang. It's really hard to see a human being in Penang. See, many human goings and human doings and human thinkings, but how many humans just being? That is a very rare sight. So how many human beings are in this world? Very few. Human thinkings and worryings and talkings and arguings and all. So, a human being, someone who's peaceful, who's just here, enjoying this moment. I should have got up there earlier maybe, but just before the talk, it was one, I shouldn't say this, but anyway, here we go. Just before the talk, I just went out just to sit on the stupa, one of my favorite places, just sitting there. And I asked, what were you doing there? Nothing, just sitting. Well, no, why? Why not? I love the idea of just doing things, not just sitting down watching your breath. You know how to, many of you know how to do that, done that many times in many meditation centers. But just sitting on the level of the stupa, just sitting there, doing nothing. Why not? A challenge. This is just peaceful, just being a human being. Not a monk, not a teacher, just a human being. And try that sometimes. Not just sitting down on your cushions, on the chairs, with the teddy bears or whatever, and just meditating. Learn how to do nothing. Just to be. And then you feel a sense of peacefulness. You're here in this moment. You're being kind to your body, kind to your mind. That's meditating. Real meditation. And sometimes you see people sitting here and, oh, they've got to do so many hours a day. They've already told themselves, this retreat, it's really hard to get on these retreats, so I'm going to do 7 hours a day. Nah, not 7 hours. Let's do 10 hours a day. Nah, let's do 12. Let's do 14 hours. How many hours are you going to meditate? And I remember, I'm guilty of this. I used to do this. And on some of these retreats, you'd go on that after the talk in the evening, you have the talk and afterwards, okay, now I'm going to meditate, nice and quiet. And you sit here meditating. And you make a resolution. I'd be the last person out of the meditation hall. I would out-meditate everybody else. And so I set my body nice and straight. I'm going to out-meditate everybody. And then after half an hour, I'd open one eye, just one eye. I don't know why one eye. And three people still meditating. Okay, another 15 minutes, sit down. Open my eye. Two people still there. Who do they think they are? Okay. And even though I was tired and sleepy and really wanted to go to bed, I've got to keep my resolution. So I open my eye again. Still that one girl, still there. What's she doing? She should know better. No, I should know better. It doesn't matter who's the last person meditating in the hall. We're not doing this to get medals from the Olympics. You know, who's going to be, who can meditate the longest or the straightest. It gets even worse when you do the walking meditation. I don't know how many of you have done the walking meditation, but sometimes you start the walking meditation and it's usually people walk very slowly. So sometimes I'm doing the walking meditation, I can do slower than that. So we have this almost like competition, not like a race who can get to the end first, but who can get to the end last. Now you can see where all that's coming from. It's a sense of ego, self, me, mine. That's not how to meditate at all. Be a human being, not a human comparing yourself with others. And this is actually how we sit down. And if you need an extra cushion, please take one. If you need a chair, please take one. In other words, you meditate how you need right now. And if somebody else, if this later on this afternoon you need to do it a different way, do it a different way. You don't always need to sit in the same place. I know this is the Sangha seats up here, but if any of you nuns want to sit up here, you're most welcome, and you can give the talk to them as well. But in other words, just be wise. Find out the best place for you. And that is actually how we start this meditating. And so that's what I do when I sit down. I don't know how I am this morning, and sometimes I wake up, feel really good energy, not so good energy, whatever. You find out how my body needs to meditate, how it needs to sit. So I've got a little cushion behind me here. Sometimes I use it, sometimes I don't. Sometimes I sit forward, sometimes I put my legs this way, sometimes put my legs another way. I find out, just like I'm making a meal, putting the ingredients in the recipe, find out what my body needs. And for that, I have these two things, the mindfulness and kindness. Those two, I always say, are together called kindfulness. Those two are most important, to be aware and also to be kind. Of course, how much awareness, how much kindness? You just wait, and those two faculties, they get very strong after a while. The mindfulness and the kindness. And when they really get strong, then you're breezing along during the day. So mindful, kind to my body. So I make sure I'm sitting reasonably comfortable. So I don't know how you're supposed to meditate. What's your position, posture? I don't know why people said you should sit like this. That was actually maybe how they sat in the time of the Buddha, only because they didn't have chairs. They had stone platforms where they could sit on. I never knew of any upholstered chairs in the time of the Buddha. Maybe they didn't have them, maybe they did, I don't know. But anyway, you sit comfortably. Why worry about sitting comfortably? Two reasons. You're developing mindfulness of your own body. And also you're being kind to it. And you're not making assumptions. This is my meditation posture. This is how I should sit to get into deep meditation. No, it can change. So the story I usually say about this, the most weird meditation posture which I ever had to get into one of the deepest of meditations was when I had scrub typhus fever. First year in Thailand, 44 years ago. Scrub typhus was caused by these little bugs, these little mites in the forest. And Ajahn Chah would always ask us during the cold season to sleep on the ground outside in the forest, like a good forest monk would do. I didn't mind that. He put a mat out, had a mosquito net. And I don't know what it was with those mosquito nets. Sometimes you see these little snakes slither past. It gave you a sense of security in a mosquito net. But any real snake, they really want, they can get in no trouble at all. And I remember Ajahn Chah saying, if ever you're in the forest and there's elephants in the forest, and often there were, he said, one of the things is to make sure if the baby elephants are always very playful, and if the baby elephant puts their trunk under your mosquito net, he said, bang it quite hard on the tip of its trunk, on the nose. And I said, he can't do that, that will hurt. He said, exactly. But we're supposed to be compassionate monks. He said, no. If you don't hit the baby elephant on the tip of the nose, it will play. And then its mother will come along, and the mother doesn't know how to play. It will just whack you and kill you. So that, fortunately, I never saw any baby elephants do that, so thankfully I was quite safe. I don't know whether you could. A little baby elephant, they're so cute. But anyway, so we used to sleep on the floor. It was safe for the Thais. because they had got an immunity from this scrub typhus. But I was an Hung Mo, a Kwai Lo. Those are the different Chinese versions of a white person. Kwai Lo means a devil man. That's from Hong Kong. But anyway, because you were a white person, you didn't have the immunity. So we'd all get this scrub typhus, which, because the Thais never got it, didn't exist. It was really unpleasant. You know, it's like typhoid. And because no one knew what was going on, oh, I can't resist telling the story about this nurse. People always think that nurses, especially in Thailand, they're already petite and beautiful. That is such a myth. Because in the monk's ward, the nurse, she was built like a water buffalo. She was so strong, and she had to be, because, especially me, I had to have an injection in the morning, injection in the afternoon. It's about 3 or 4 weeks. And like a cocktail of antibiotics, because no one knew what it was. You're not supposed to have scrub typhus in that part of the world. It's only found out about 6 months or 9 months later on when some doctor visited and said, why are all you white monks getting this disease and no other one is? And he did some research and found it was scrub typhus. But they didn't know when I was there. So different types of antibiotics in the morning, in the afternoon, in your backside. And this nurse would come on your backside, or on your front rather, and she'd take the needle. And this was, you know, 45 years ago. So there's no sort of one-use needles in those days. All like reusable ones. You know, they would just try and sterilize them. And this is a poor part of the world. 45 years ago, it was third world place. And it was amongst, we were supposed to be the tough guys. I remember later on giving some blood. And they said, oh, you're a monk, so you don't need any anesthetic. So just put the thing straight into your skin and just got the blood out. So we were tough in those days. Not like monks these days in the back of there. No, you're all tough. But anyway, so stab, stab on the backside. And after about 3 or 4 days, my bottom, I was going to say something else there, was so sore. And every time that this nurse came in, bang again, and I did do my chanting, like the loving kind of, may all beings be happy and well, but I had to make exception. Not that nurse. She hurt me so bad. I was only a young monk. Anyway, so one day, it was about 3 or 4 weeks in hospital, felt really terrible, no energy, just waiting for the nurse to come again, back on my backside. So anyway, I decided, let's do some meditation. Of course, Ajahn Chah came to visit beforehand, a couple of days before. And now you always think your master, the great teacher, would be very helpful. The fact he came to visit me, that was just so uplifting. He was, you know, becoming quite a famous monk at the time. I was only just ordained, maybe about 6 months or a year or something. I was very junior, and he came to visit me. Such a nice thought. And he came up to the bedside, and I was looking for some nice words of encouragement. And all he said to me was, Brahma Wangsa, he said, you're either going to get better or you're going to die. And he turned around and left. That was just that. That actually hurt at the time. Because that's the trouble with, you know, living with an Ajahn Chah. You can't find fault with him. Now, that's true. You're either going to get better or you're going to die. What's the problem? But that's not what I was used to and expecting. Great wisdom, terrible bedside manner. What a great... But anyway, so there you're left on your own. And just a couple of days later, getting more and more fed up. You're depressed. You could, probably was depressed. You know, simply because of the no energy. So I decided, okay, let's meditate. So I decided to just do my meditation. And that's when you just got really deep in your mind, body vanished, deep inside, having a wonderful time inside. And then later on you came out. Wow. You know, the first thing I looked at was the position of my body, my posture. One leg was this way, one leg was that way, an arm this way, an arm that way. Have you ever seen somebody in bed, you know, when they've got a fever, they're all over the place. So because of that, I thought, you know, this idea of having to be in a certain posture to get deep meditation, there's so much. Oh, I'm going to introduce this word now, if you haven't heard it before. It's called gomayang. Gomayang is a Pali word. Go means ball, B-U-L-L. Mayang, which is what comes out of the backside of the ball, S-H-I-T. So gomayang means... I'll say it there, bullshit. Yeah, no, that's the word we use in Australia and England and many countries to say that's a lot of rubbish, it's not true. So the idea you have to be in a certain posture to get in deep meditation, that is gomayang. So somehow or other I think I can get out of being accused of saying bad words. Anyway. So you don't need to be in this posture or that posture. It's all about sort of the mind letting go of the body so it's comfortable, however you can manage it to be. And so then you find out, wow, as long as the body feels comfortable, that is really good posture. So that's one of the reasons why you look at your body with mindfulness and kindness, really relaxing it to the max. The mindfulness, you really are aware of it. You don't just look, oh, my, how are you, body? Okay, that's good enough, and then, no, really look at it. Have you ever done the sweeping meditations? At home with a broom? Now this is a real sweeping meditation. I usually start with my toes, feel my toes. Can you be aware? Don't look at your toes now. Don't look at them. Can you feel them? Move them. Wiggle them. Of course you can feel them. But it's one of those sensations which we don't really bother about unless there's a problem down there. But when you meditate, you start to be able to become aware of all these different parts of the body. And you move the awareness up, as slow as you like, or fast as you like, doesn't matter. But don't be in too much of a rush. People in our modern world, we go way too fast. So move up your body, feel the body. Feel what it's like as you move way up the body. Go through the organs. You don't have to know where they are, what they are. But just as you go up the body, you can feel stuff. And there's something there which is not balanced. I call it not balanced. Don't call it hurting or pain, because sometimes that's not the right word. You feel it, and if it needs some attention, you feel there's something wrong there. There's something not quite right. It's imbalanced, I like the word. Stay there and balance the whole thing with your mindfulness and kindness. Of course, I've done that so often, and it's amazing just what you can do. Okay, the time for my food poisoning story. Monastery over the road there. And you're quite okay to visit that monastery during this retreat. A nice little walk. It's only 15 minutes. It's very safe. The meditation hall over there, ooh, that's got lots of power. So many people like meditating over there. You're most welcome to. But anyway, in my cave, which I live over there, oh, I had food poisoning. Real food poisoning. Not just tummy ache, but I was sitting in my cave and just, oh, I felt really sick. Ah! One of the reasons I tell this story is because towards the end of a talk, people get a bit bored, it's a bit hot, a bit tired. So we do, ah! It does grab people's attention. It's amazing. And it was just the result of just, you know, the cramps, the agonizing cramps, which go, ah! With food poisoning. And so, well, then I was in my cave and just these cramps started getting worse and worse and worse. And even though I was screaming, ah! No one could hear me. That was the whole point of having a cave. You know, so I can go in there and so I couldn't hear what was going on outside. So I could have some peace and quiet. But of course, if I can't hear what's going on outside, the people outside can't hear what's going on inside. So that was a bit of a design fault in the cave. But I don't mind because I know how to deal with these stuff. So, what should I do? Open the doors and call to the telephone. Oh, this is Australia. You know, if you try and get an ambulance out here, you know, to say where exactly it is. Oh, we had a crazy lady here once. Actually, not once, many times. Different ones. Oh, she came and so, no, she was a bit violent. She still had the band on her wrist from the hospital, I think the Bentley, where she was getting treatment for her, I think, schizophrenia. And then she came, she said, oh, no, I heard your voice calling me to the monastery. I never called you. You did. So we rang up the psychiatric emergency team to try. And so it took them a while to get here. And then she threw a cup at me. Very quick, dodged. And then when I told that to the psychiatric emergency team, said, oh, violence, we need to have police as well. So they said, we can't actually attend to this. I'd already waited an hour for them to come. And they can't really do anything until the police come. So we'll stay at the front. So then they called the local police. The local police, they hadn't heard of Bodhidharma Monastery. This is local police. So they were all the way around Serpentine Dam and around this way looking for us. And about another couple of hours went past. And when they came, they said, okay, we can go down there. And so, you know, the police and the psychiatric people there, she admitted she made a mistake, and so it's going back to the hospital. But then they had to go with the psychiatrist, and the psychiatrist had been waiting so long that their battery had run out of power, so they couldn't drive their car. And the police said, well, it's against our rules to let you go in our car. And it was this crazy lady, we were supposed to be doing stuff. Anyway, so I thought, no, it's a waste of time trying to get an ambulance out here. So anyway, I don't need ambulances, too much fuss and bother. So instead, meditation. So sat up there with, ah, and ooh. But what meditation was? Mindfulness and kindness. You zoom in to the problem. Zoom in, don't zoom out. Don't try and get somewhere else where the problem doesn't exist. Go right into it, see what it is. And as soon as you go into it, give it this beautiful kindness. There you are. Poor, this is my tummy. Okay, there, poor tummy. I'm sure you'll be okay. And with that kindness, you know what I notice, and I've seen this so many times before, I think you can understand this. If you're kind to something, it gets less painful. That's why you have these beautiful, beautiful nurses. I don't mean like good looking, I mean just were kind. They just smile or just, you know, talk to you and give you some reassurance. Unfortunately, that many nurses can't do that anymore. They haven't got time. They've got to write reports instead of being kind. So anyway, when someone is kind like that, a lot of the aches and pains just get much less. So I was kind to my food poisoning, to my poor stomach or intestines, I forget where it was, and just relaxing them. Relax to the max. You should be fine, no problem at all. And you know what I noticed? Every time I was a little bit kind to that agony, it got slightly less agonizing. And a little less agonizing. A little less agonizing. And I kept on doing this for about half an hour. At the end of half an hour, no more food poisoning. No more contractions, no more agonizing cramps, no more pain at all. So I just meditated. I was really surprised how wonderful it is. All these wonderful techniques and teachings from the Buddha, how to meditate, you can even relax your food poisoning away. And totally went. Half an hour it took. If I'd have struggled to the phone, it would have taken about 3 or 4 hours if I'd have survived at all. But it's wonderful to have been able to know how to be aware of your body. So aware of it, so mindful of it. You can do all sorts of weird stuff with it, which is great. And you can do that. This is not something which is, you know, some psychic power which you have to believe other people. This is something you can do yourself. When you get a cold, You had aches and pains, diarrhea, cancers, all this other stuff in your body. Get to know it. Understand it. Don't be afraid of it, trying to get rid of it. It's a teacher. So really get to understand it and know it, and then it's amazing just what you can do with these things. So that's a sweeping of the body, being mindful and kind to it, understanding how my body works, what it needs. Sometimes people say, oh, you shouldn't take that food, you shouldn't take this food. No. Each one of you knows exactly what is good for you. Of course, there's sometimes desires, but if you're really meditating and you're mindful, you're kind, you know exactly what this body needs, your body needs. Follow that. To be a healthy person. Well, was it good? This really nice old fellow. I was going to say his name, but I think some of you might sort of find out exactly who it is. He had lung cancer. People smoked in those days, and so he went to the hospice over in it was in Murdoch. But just as it opened, he was one of the first customers there. And the doctor had given up on him, maybe a week, 2 weeks at most. And then, so when he went there to die, the nurse came up to him the first evening and said, "What do you want for dinner tonight?" And he said, "Well, I can't have anything salty. I've got really hardened arteries. I can't have anything oily because I've got high cholesterol. I can't have anything." And the nurse looked at him and said, "What on earth are you talking about? You are not going to die of a heart attack. You're not going to die of hardened arteries. You're going to die of cancer. You can eat whatever you want," said the nurse. I said, "Really?" "Yeah." So he ordered the sweetest, saltiest, oiliest food, which his wife had never let him get close to, even smell, of the last 3 or 4 years. And he really enjoyed himself. He enjoyed himself so much, and this is absolutely a true story. About 6 days later, he left the hospice walking on his own two legs. He was in remission. That little bit of happiness had just given him so much energy that, you know, he went back 6 months later to die properly. But he had an extra 6 months. Now, what's that telling you? What's that telling you is that sometimes that if you understand how your body works with mindfulness, and I don't mean indulgence, I mean understanding, wisdom, kindness. There's a lot of difference between kindness and indulgence. If you understand this body, you can actually have a really healthy body and really relax it. So the first few days you come on a meditation retreat, you know, you've been working, you've been worrying about your family, travelling around, doing all sorts of stuff. Of course you're going to be tired. You have a lot of stress in your body. So let that stress go, first of all. How do you let the stress go? Oh, find out, where are you, stress? Oh, there you are. Okay, you can relax now. There we go. These little teddy bears. That's what we have them here for. People say, if this was a real meditation retreat, we wouldn't have teddy bears, we'd have Zen sticks back. Not teddy bears. You try a Zen meditation stick retreat, or you try a teddy bear retreat. Which one works? For all of you, you're all motivated enough. You're over-motivated. So a teddy bear just relaxes you. Safe, warm, cuddly, which gives you this beautiful sense of kindness and gentleness and being here. It's pleasant to be here with a teddy bear in your lap, which means that you can relax. And when you relax, your body relaxes. When your body relaxes, it gets healthy. You can sleep well at night. You can eat just the right amount of food, because a lot of times people overeat or undereat because of, you know, some problems with their body. They don't know how to deal with it. When you understand your body, you're aware of it, oh, it's much easier to deal with all sorts of stuff. So, when we get to do body awareness first of all, and that's what the Buddha kept on saying, kaya gata sati, body awareness first of all. And once your body gets really relaxed, it feels delightful. The delightful feeling of bodily relaxation is why people spend a lot of money to go to resorts. But this is a resort. Serpentine Resort. Jada Grove Resort, Club Med. Because it can be really comfortable. Sit in a nice chair. Go and... in the corner. Sometimes it says sitting in the corner is for the naughty people, but not for you. You're wise, get there first of all. Because it's nice, you can lean back, and it's nice and comfortable. You can put a cushion behind you, cushion in front of you. Make it comfortable, important. And when you are kind to the body, after a while the body really likes it. In the fires over in the east, is one of those monasteries and temples got affected. That was Wat Buddha Dhamma in the middle of, Darug National Park or whatever. But anyway, that one that I gave a retreat there years ago, on that retreat, the doctor, who's a doctor, a physician who was taking me to that retreat, he called the meditation hall. He said every time I went there, every day on the retreat, I sort of called it the torture chamber. I'm going to go to the torture. I said, what? Well, you know, I had to sit for an hour, even if I was tired and my legs were aching, my back was sore. I had to do it because everyone had to. I thought, what crazy meditation is this? Because just trying to torture your body like that. And he started calling it the torture chamber. So when I went, I was teaching this retreat. When I was teaching, I said, listen, this is not the torture chamber. I think that's why I started calling it Club Med. Club meditation, because club meditation gives a different idea. This is happiness. This is joy. And when it's joyful, you actually look forward to going to the meditation hall. And if, you know, it gets about 45 minutes and you get tired, get out. Change your posture. Move it this way, move it that way. Because then you're being mindful and kind to your own body. You're adapting to it. And just as an important point, if you think, oh, during meditation you have to sit perfectly still, you're not allowed to move, not at all. No, don't move, stop moving. That is like just being in a real torture chamber. Be kind. So I'm kind to my body, and if it needs to move, I move it. But after a while, because I'm kind to it, after a while it settles down. And you can sit for hours just sitting here, perfectly happy, content, because you've been kind to your body. Oh, I'm 68 now. I should have much more aches and pains in my body at 68, but it's pretty good because I know how to look after it with mindfulness and kindness. So when you know that, then you can have a really healthy body, and you're being with it, you're not trying to escape from it. So when you do that, you get this beautiful sense of the delightful relaxation. Same reason why people do go on these holidays, and they sit down by the beach on the recliners with a glass of water next to them, watching the waves of the beach come in and go out. Not a care, not a worry in the whole world. And people spend a lot of money for that. Instead, you can just come to Jhana Grove, do it for free. Just sitting down in your meditation cushion, you've got your water next to you, enjoying a delightful experience in the body, perfectly relaxed. Just like some of you get up early in the morning, you're in the bed, and it's nice and cozy. You don't want to get up. That delightful relaxation. Whenever that happens, you know, there was a time when I was scared of delight. Monks are not supposed to have fun. Of course we have lots of fun. Some of the jokes we tell each other. Anyway, I won't go there. I'll get embarrassed. Okay, yeah, so we'll go there. I can't resist, it's a good funny story. Some of you have heard these ones before. What is the last part of the human body which stops when you die? The last part of the human body which stops before you die. It's the pupils of the eye. It's the last part. You know why? Because only the pupils dilate. That's true, that's logical, you can't. Later on, sometimes you read some Buddhism, people say, oh, your body is like living in a prison. I didn't realize how correct the Buddha was. Your body is a prison, I can prove it. How your body is a prison, what's it made of? Cells. So your body's a prison. So anyway, back to when he delights in relaxation, your body feels so easy and it's comfortable. And interestingly, what I discovered, the insight which I got from this, is when I just focus on the delight of a relaxed body in the beginning of meditation, the relaxation goes to a deeper level. It's like the mind sees delight and wants more of it. And it just relaxes the body even more. So I often, whenever I get relaxed, sitting meditation, and I notice the delight feels really good, and I go deeper into the delight and it relaxes more. And that's an important teaching. Because later on, we go into our mind, we relax that in the same way as we relax the body. Looking at it, letting go of this, letting go, zooming into the problems, finding out why, and relaxing the whole thing. And soon your mind gets so delightful, a joyful mind, a happy mind. And instead of thinking, uh-oh, attachments, be careful of enjoying yourself. Enjoyment has nothing to do with anything spiritual or religious. You've got to be tough if you want to get enlightened. That is what we call gomayang. It was so wonderful to actually read in the suttas. The Buddha saying, do not be afraid of that delight. Get into it. Practice it. It's not a problem. And you saw in the meditation, you get to these meditations on the breath or whatever, and the delightful breath, joys and happiness. And in this was in the first part of the suttas, the Digha Nikaya. And it starts off with the Brahmajala Sutta, but the next sutta is the Samanyapala Sutta. And there the Buddha starts this is the second sutta apparently recited in the caves outside of Rajagaha when they try to get all of the teachings together. The joys, the fruits of monastic life, of letting go. And this was comparing, the Buddha was comparing his life to a king's life. A king with the best food, the harem, whatever music he wanted, everything he wanted, and it was there for him. This was the king. And the Buddha gave all that up for a higher pleasure, a better pleasure, not pleasure, pleasure, pleasure. Just having a body which was so at ease, could sleep well at night without any worries at all. A mind which was so joyful, so happy. You can just close your eyes and get into bliss. And went through all these bliss states of meditation and said, which is the highest? And the king realized, oh, okay, yeah, now I understand why you're a monk. We're not a monk because we run away. You become monks and nuns because you run towards something, not run away from stuff. You get inspired and have joy and more joy. And really good joy. And really, oh, that was a really sweet joy. And a sweeter joy than that. Oh, yeah, bring me more. And I'm not exaggerating. So this is what happens when you learn how to be mindful and kind. So as far as insight is concerned, for me, insight is measured by your peace. How still you can be. How you can meditate. You don't need anything at all. In fact, the less you have, the more free you feel. and how you can get to those beautiful states which are so delightful, so wonderful. And that's what the meditation is. So that's why we meditate. And how we meditate. And said, can you please tell us, Ajahn Brahm, how to walk in meditation, how to watch the breath? I've already done that. Be aware. Be kind. And all these things will come to you. And then you'll be sitting here, just very quickly because I'm talking way too long. You're sitting here and you just the body gets very relaxed, delightful. Enjoy that until the body vanishes. And then just watching the mind, this present moment, so delightful. Who needs the past? Who needs the future? You know the reason why you think about the past? It's because you're not enjoying the present. The only reason you plan for the future, same reason, you're not enjoying the now. When you really get into the present moment, the now is a really nice place to be. Check it out. There's lots of space in the present moment. It's always here for you. So really get into it, and you don't want to go anywhere. You've got an ache or a pain. Doesn't matter. It's going to be there if I try and get into the future or the past. I'm going to be with it right now. And, especially if you relax the body first of all, there's not much aches and pains there left. And then you're in this moment, you're just enjoying this moment. But all my worries and concerns, all the stuff I have to do later on, who knows? There may not be any later on. Maybe an Iranian missile is already targeted for Bodhinyana Monastery or Jhana Grove. It's on its way. Maybe there won't be a future for you. Yeah, isn't that a wonderful, nice idea? So you don't have to think about the future. It means the only reason you think about the future is because you're not enjoying the present. If you really enjoy the present moment, who needs a future? So, we're in this moment, enjoying this moment. And then, is there anything left moving? The breath. You can just watch it naturally. These days, I've been meditating for so long, I never choose to watch the breath, it just comes to me. Watching the breath, enjoying it. And then it gets so peaceful, so still. Why? Because your vehicle's in the garage. Your body's not doing very much. So it just doesn't need much oxygen, so it gets really less breathing. Breathing out. Oh, that's cool. And after a while, you don't need to breathe anymore. It's so cool. The coolness, the joy is what's left. It's just the joy, the bliss stays with you. And the bliss turns into these beautiful lights we call the nimittas. And it's just really fascinating, wonderful. Body just, where's the body gone? Who cares? Body just sitting there, totally enjoying itself. But you're not really aware of the body. You're aware of your mind. Just so joyful, so peaceful. And then you get into the jhanas. Whoa. And then you come out of the jhanas. Whoa. Then you become enlightened. Whoa. And then you know why we meditate. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Very good. So anyone who wants to try teddy bears, lots of teddy bears all over the place, over there. I know it's really, somebody's arranged those. So you can always borrow a teddy bear. My teddy bear likes to have other people to cuddle it as well as me.